Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the March Citizens Climate Lobby call. If you are new to the call, Amy, can you do that again? If you're new to the call, my name is Mark Reynolds. I'll be hosting today's call. And the first thing I want to do is welcome the groups that are new since last month. So I apologize. I'm going to butcher this, New Hampshire. Monadoc, New Hampshire. Clemson, South Carolina, College Station, Texas, Monterey, California, including, just so everybody knows, part of the founding of the Monterey chapter was one of the people who helped to open the famous one there, so that's kind of cool. South Tahoe, California, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and North Denver, Colorado. So welcome to all of you who are new groups. Let me just tell you, if you're new, I'll be introducing our speaker in just a moment, but just so you know a little bit about the people who you're on the call with, these are the most committed, persistent people you're ever going to work with. So we have been doing this call every month for the last 89 straight months on the first Saturday of each month. And there are some people who have been on every call. So the people who are on this call with you are people who are going to see it through. They're not kind of mouse-click advocacy people or people who go to one march or sent their $20 in and figure they've done what they need to do. They're people who, if they did something last month, they'll do something this month also. And also, in terms of persistence, it's just kind of a character of the people who are on the call. It's not just the people who have been on for all 89 months, but I saw a note from someone who's starting one of our newest chapters in Honolulu that he's made himself two shirts. The both of which say, want to do something about climate change? Ask us. Now, why does he have two? Well, one he wears and one he washes is because he's determined until we actually pass climate fee and dividend legislation, he will wear one of those shirts and tell them. So I think that is just spectacular. There's something else you should know about the people you're joining the call with also, and that is that the people who are part of CCL have found a way of bringing a certain amount of joy and fun to this process, which I think is absolutely essential. We know enough about the brain now to know that if you only function from fear, you have a very limited part of your capacity to deal with big issues like global warming. So finding ways to expand ourselves and deal with all of our capacities are really important. And so I loved an email I got from Jolie Nowak, one of our Midwestern group leaders, who said, you know, you've been to too many climate talks recently when you're shoveling your walk and you're worrying about the albedo effect that has on the planet. So for those of you who need to look up the word albedo, that has to do with the reflection of light back, you know, by snow and ice, so that that actually helps us with global warming. So I think it's important that we also can kind of make fun of ourselves, because we tend to be super intense people on this issue, and getting notes like that from people like Julie is just really, really important part of the puzzle. Okay, so let me just check again. Okay, very good. Dr. Oreskes, did you have a chance to join us?
Hello.
Oh. Yeah, is that you, Naomi?
It is, yes. Sorry, I'm a minute or too late.
No, that is just no problem. This is exactly right. So before we introduce our speaker, we were fortunate enough to find Dr. Oreskes. Naomi Oreskes has been a guest on our call. I think many of you have read her book, Merchants of Doubt, but now the movie's coming out. And so, Naomi, we just wanted to hear, you know, a minute about the movie, you know, where it's going to be released, anything that we can do to help it get in front of as many people as possible. And then if you could verify, some of the reviews I've read said that the romance themes are very steamy, and I just wanted to see if that's in fact the case.
Yeah, I'm having a passionate romance with Mark Morano in this movie.
I heard it was Senator Inhofe, but that's even better.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's a little old for me, but, you know.
All right. Well, tell us about the movie and what we can do to help get it in front of as many people as possible.
Fabulous. Thanks, Trivik. Yeah, well, so the film is the same title as the book, Merchants of Doubt. It was produced by Robbie Kenner, who was the filmmaker who made the film Food, Inc., which many people saw about the food industry, and that was nominated for an Academy Award. So he's a great filmmaker. It's been a great experience working with him, and we think he's really done justice to the topic. The film's a little different from the book in that it's a little bit more present-focused, so it's kind of brings the debate up to date and focuses a little bit more on people who are still really actively in the denial campaign compared to the book, which was a little bit more the book was tracing the denial campaign back to its origins and trying to answer the question, well, where did this come from in the first place, and why did these people do this thing? So the movie shifts it a little bit more towards the present, but the basic argument, the basic goal of the film is the same as the book, to, you know, explain climate change denial, to expose who these people are, to show the way this debate is not about the science, which has been settled for a long time, but it's about politics and ideology.
Great. And what can we do to help get it as many people to see it as possible?
Well, it'd be super terrific if you guys would be willing to send something out to your membership, and I can, you know, I can write something, or you could write something and send it past me to look at. We've actually done that with a couple of other different groups. Forecast the Facts sent out an email from me a few days ago, and Environmental Defense is about to send one out. So it would be great if we could do that, and we just sent emails saying, you know, the film's out, go see it, go tell people about it, let's use this to energize and mobilize people to say, you know, it's time to get past denial and focus on solutions, which is, of course, what Citizens Climate Lobby is all about.
Okay, we will do that at the very least. I'll have Steve collaborate with you on that, and we'll get it out, and thank you so much for doing this. We're really, really excited about it. I got a call from Bob Inglis about it a couple of days ago about how excited he is. So I know
I was going to say that. Yeah, I mean, I think your people would love it because Bob's in the film, and he's very articulate in the film, specifically talks about a carbon tax as an alternative to income tax. He talks about, you know, taxing the things you don't want, like carbon pollution, and tax and less of the things you do want, like income. So I think Bob's a great spokesperson in the film for the things that Citizens Climate Lobby is all about. And you asked about when it's playing and where it's showing, so let me just say that. If the film has already opened, it opened yesterday in New York City and Los Angeles. If you're in New York, it's at Lincoln Plaza Theater and at the Angelica Film Center down in the Village. If you're in L.A., I don't remember which theaters it was at in L.A., but I can forward. You can go to Merchants of Doubt, the Sony webpage. It has a list of theaters, or I can send that. I put that on my, if you're following my Twitter feed, at Naomi Oreskes, I tweeted this morning the link to the website that has the full list of cities around the country. So it's already open in New York and Los Angeles. On the 13th, it goes to Chicago and a couple of other major cities. And then on the 20th, it opens across the country. So Boston, San Diego, Miami, Atlanta, pretty much most major metropolitan areas will have it. And then there's going to be a theatrical run that we hope will go through May or June, although obviously it depends. And then once the theatrical run is finished, then we can also do screenings with groups like yourselves. If people have local chapters of Citizens Climate Lobby and they want to do a screening for your local chapter, that can be arranged too, and I can give you the information about who to contact at Sony and Participant Media. And Participant are really interested. It was produced, Robbie Kenner made the film, our production company is Participant Media, and our distributor is Sony, and some of you know, may know, Participant Media are the folks who did An Inconvenient Truth. They also did Food, Inc. They also did The Help. They're very much all about connecting films that make a difference in the world and connecting them with people who are interested in collaborating. So Participants very interested in collaborations with activist groups, citizens groups, NGOs, different kinds of people. So if anyone's interested in that, we can make that happen too. But after June, if you ask for that now, they'll get all stressed and tell you to go away. But definitely after June and all through next year, we'll have all kinds of opportunities to do additional events.
Fantastic. And we will be doing a ton of that. And we also want to cycle you back on one of these monthly calls as soon as possible, so Steve will get to you on that. But thank you so much for making yourself available this morning. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for all your help and all your great work.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks, Naomi.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, take care. All right, so our guest speaker this month is Lonnie Ellis from Catholic Climate Covenant. We have wanted Lonnie and his organization on the call for a bit. For those of you who were at our faith-based panel at the National Conference last year, you know that Lonnie absolutely knocked it out of the yard. And then also, the timing is just so perfect given we're expecting the Pope's encyclical this summer. What we would like to do is, Mr. Ellis, if you could tell us a little bit more about the organization, tell us about what you expect from the Pope's encyclical, you know, what we could do to leverage any of that. If there's time for questions in a little bit, we'll start in Madison, then we'll go to Petoskey and then Omaha. If there's still time, then we'll go to Boston and Toronto because they submitted the most number of field reports this month. So, Lonnie, welcome welcome to our call, and thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, you're crystal clear. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, it's great to talk to you all. I love to run into CCL people around the country, and a shout-out to Minnesota in particular. There are good connections between the faith community and CCL out there, I know. I'm from a farm out in Minnesota. So, I will anticipate some of the themes of the encyclical today, but since it's the first ever papal encyclical on ecology here, and it's not out yet, of course, I'll talk mostly about context, what an encyclical is, hopefully without being boring, and the influence of this particular one. So the Catholic Climate Covenant, we leverage the power of the Catholic community to protect people and the planet. We arose out of the U.S. Bishops Conference 9 years ago. That's the policy arm of the bishops. We're a coalition of 14 major Catholic organizations, some of the organizations that you would know, like Catholic Charities, Catholic Colleges and Universities are part of us, Sisters Congregations, and we leverage their power to move policy discussions as well as educating and reducing the church's carbon footprint. We also like op-eds and LTEs a lot, and we've been kind of building that little strategy up after getting some advice from you all, of course. So an encyclical letter due out in June or July, and first, what is an encyclical? So in 1928, Governor Alfred Smith was running for president, and there was this article critical about whether a Catholic, like he, could be president, and encyclicals laid out authority of the church, and that the article said that a Catholic president would be torn between the Constitution and the Vatican, and this was brought to Governor Smith's attention, and he said, what the hell is an encyclical? So it's, it's not generally that known about what these things are, except that people are really excited about this one because of the message and the messenger. And the message is going to be about climate change, but it's going to be about generally ecology and church teaching on how we relate to ecology, but climate change will be a prominent part of that. So it's both the message and the messenger in this pope in particular. Just a little bit of context here. This is coming at a time when debate is like so ripe on climate change, and popes have done this kind of thing before. So Pope Leo, 1891, when industrialization was happening to a really large extent, there was this miserable poverty among working people. He issued encyclical that affirmed unions as well as private property. It was just like really, coming out to help form debate at a very crucial time. Another one during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Peace on Earth, 1963. So it's a tool, really, that a pope can use to raise up some moral issues as we debate something that's really, hot and crucial for humanity's future. And the reason why so many people are paying attention to this upcoming encyclical is that it's about the messenger as well, right? So, all the images of him just being with the people, including people who have health issues and or are outcast in some way, him walking through the slums, and all these images that we have from the media. By the way, a priest friend of mine at the Vatican says he's even more wildly with the people like this when the cameras aren't around. Mm-hmm. They never know what he's going to do next. And he has approval ratings that politicians would kill for. I know there are D.C. strategists who are going around talking to members of Congress. They show a picture of the Pope with his big smile, and he says, you don't want to go up against this guy on climate change, okay? So this is potentially a game changer that's the term that a lot of people are using about this encyclical. And the influence of this, the Vatican has affirmed that the Pope is very interested in influencing Paris. Just like these popes in the past influenced Soviet-U.S. relations in the 60s and things like that, like this Pope is thinking along those kind of groundbreaking terms and wants to influence Paris. Now, it's going to be a document that's like 50 or 60 pages, and so it's going to be heavily interpreted. not many people are going to read it. They're going to read summaries of it. They're going to read all kinds of commentary, and they're going to view it from their same ideological lens that they view most things. So let me give some of my thoughts on what the themes of this encyclical will be. I mean, this pope took the name of Francis, and I'm a lay Franciscan, and that I love that. And that means maybe two things: solidarity with the poor, and Francis was also a lover of God's creation. And I think we've seen that again and again throughout Pope Francis, and that's actually what he named as why he took the name of Francis, is those two things, the poor and in God's creation. So I'll kind of talk about three themes that I anticipate being in the encyclical. One is that our human relations are intertwined with ecological relations. The term that Pope Benedict used is human ecology and natural ecology, and those are inseparably linked, so that the health of our human relations affects the environment, you know, not just climate change, but also pollution, deforestation. These things will be in the encyclical as well. It's not just about climate change. And we, you know, harm humanity when we mistreat the environment, and when we mistreat humans, that affects the environment as well. You know, wars are terrible for the environment, right? So the intertwining of these relations, he'll have a strong economic critique as part of this theme of human relations, and he talks about the culture and economy of exclusion versus a culture or economy of solidarity and encounter. And so if we can exclude from our concern and our economy whole groups of people like immigrants and poor people, then we'll exclude nature and we'll destroy ecosystems as well. So like this inner spiritual dishealth is coming out with all kinds of ramifications outwardly is part of the theology and the spirituality that will be embedded in the encyclical, I am sure. So the second theme is care for God's creation. And from Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and all that it holds. So it is not ours to do whatever we want with God's creation, but it has intrinsic value in itself because God animates creation. God is holding up creation, and we don't have the right to just do whatever we want with it. That gets into stewardship, what's our proper role. And then the third thing that I would say I anticipate being in the encyclical is the wisdom to act now. And wisdom, another term of the cardinal virtue in Catholic theology, is called prudence. And that means we don't have to know everything to know that we must act. I think that virtue is, it's really needed right now. And it's something that's been lifted up by the U.S. bishops when they wrote about climate change back in 2001. It was heavily, this document by all the bishops in the country talked a lot about prudence. So those are some of my thoughts on what is likely to actually be in the encyclical. And then I'd like to share some thoughts on messaging and some of the things that we could all be on the same page about, possibly, in terms of things that we want to lift up and messaging. So I like to keep things in three. I guess I'm Trinitarian that way. So the first thing that I would like to say about messaging is to talk about the church here is giving moral guidance. So one of the first questions that people are going to have and have been having is, why is the Pope talking about climate change? You know, like, shouldn't the Pope be talking about what they call faith and morals, even though, like, you know, please, this is a very immoral issue here. I think we have to think of communicating that, okay, the Pope here is speaking as a pastor, offering moral guidance. He's speaking as a scientist, not trying to be a politician. He's talking about the moral implications and that we have an ethical obligation to protect people now and our future generations. a quote from a philosopher you may have heard is, the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children. Right, so there's a lot around the moral implications of what we are doing now for the future and for people right now. And another piece of the moral guidance here that we have to talk about, I think, is the continuity of teaching. So we have this, obviously, a long-standing tradition on care for creation. We think about the book of Genesis, you know, goes way back before Earth Day or anything that we came up with here recently. But not only that long-standing care for creation tradition, but even on climate change, now St. John Paul II, Pope Benedict, they both talked about climate change in particular, greenhouse gases and this. And the U.S. bishops talked about, well, there's a big document that I mentioned, the 2001 document on climate change in particular. And in 1981, the year I was born, the bishops talked about climactic changes, food shortages, and they said, quote, it would be the height of folly to tamper in ignorance with the ecology of the entire planet. So, you know, not only have scientists been onto this, but the church has been thinking about the moral implications of what we might be doing to the ecology of the planet for a long, long time. And I think this continuity message is really important because if you've seen some of the attacks that have been coming out, I mean, folks who want to keep burning fossil fuels without limits, they really are feeling threatened by this move. And you may have seen around January 1, Fox News had a really, like, pretty brilliant piece in trying to separate Catholics from the Pope on this.
Mm.
And they start out by saying, the new boss is not like the old boss.
Mm.
And he has this idea of having an encyclical on climate change. And you know, a couple things that they're doing here is, one, they're going to play up that this is a Latin American pope. He's like this Latin American leftist. He's not like us, right? It's about an identity thing that I think they're trying to put this division in for us Catholics and for all of society to turn against this guy. Remember, this guy has approval ratings that are skyrocketing even among non-Catholics, right? And so in this Fox News piece continues in saying, like, you know, he's doing all this stuff about welcoming gays and lesbians, and then now he's taking on climate change. Like, what is this guy doing next? So the important thing that these guys would like all of us to forget is that St. John Paul II talked about this in 1990. The U.S. bishops have talked about this since 1981. Pope Benedict also talking about climate change in particular. That we have to raise up again and again. And then, so that's something that the church has to stand really strong on. And then you all as well, you know, one of the messages that I think is really important is that, and this is my second point on messaging, is it's about people. And, you know, all the time when I talk to people who are kind of, you know, not in our world of climate change, they're like, oh, climate change, you know, I'm not really much of an environmentalist. And, you know, people are suffering now. You know, not only could we talk about the statistics, you know, 150,000 people dying every year right now because of climate change according to the World Health Organization, but we have to tell a story. Right, and who is it that's close to you and someone that your audience can identify with who is being impacted by climate change? I can go back to the farm where I'm from, and the weather patterns have been changing. My brother has been having a very difficult time getting into the fields at different times because of the heavy precipitation events. Downpours that have been coming is another, you know, observed fact right now because of climate change. So it's about people and got to tell a story, right? You all know how to do that. And then the last thing that I would say about our messaging is to offer a lot of hope and a call for urgent action, of course. And so that's the basics of, you know, it's real, it's a big deal, and we have solutions. And you all do a great job of this as well, appealing to self-interest. especially when you're talking to fence sitters, kind of persuadable people. I just learned that that the U.S. is number one in energy, in wind energy around the world, in terms of actual electricity generation. And, you know, China actually has more wind turbines, but ours have been more efficient, better placed, you know, best technology. Like, and you all know how to talk to folks who would find a lot of, like, U.S. pride in being a lead on the solutions. I think that's going to be a huge piece. And our, you know, we can't let people feel like we can't do anything about it, right? We have to have hope. We got to be a people of hope, and people of faith have to be leaders on that as well. Now, let me say something about the timing of this, just to bring it home a little bit here. This encyclical in June or July is coming out at the same time, around the same time as the EPA Clean Power Plan rules will be finalized. So that's a hot political time as well. And then also, of course, the post-visit in September to Washington, D.C., to New York, and then to Philadelphia. His address to Congress and the UN, I'm sure he's going to be talking about climate change. And that's around the same time as the start of the presidential primary debates. So we have some opportunities here if we keep them in mind of how are these things are all landing at the same time and how we can amplify a moral message on climate change at the right time. So lastly, I'll talk about the plans that we have both with church leaders and plans for the grassroots. So we are working with U.S. cardinals and bishops to be prepared and to be placed in media and giving strong interviews, standing with the Pope right away when this comes out, to inoculate against some of this division that some are trying to create, and have events with bishops highlighting local impacts of climate change around the country. From the grassroots standpoint, maybe we'll get an advanced copy of the encyclical at the Catholic Climate Covenant. I really hope so. We're trying hard. And we are developing resources for how we can be ready and how we can help others be ready once this comes out. You know, the day it comes out, to have a bunch of things to send out to people, key quotes, messages that are coming out from this, and then even in the next day, another round of resources. So you all can sign up on our website to get these as well, CatholicClimateCovenant.org, to get updates on the encyclical and tools right away. So some of these tools can include social media graphics, right, to post with quotes from the encyclical. Like, there's going to be a number of zingers, and we're going to have, like, a team of people, like, going through these 50, 60 pages. I'm told right now it's much longer than that, so but hopefully I think they're paring it down. Pull up, you know, this Pope loves zingers and one-liners. Get some of those really great pieces and get them out the day the encyclical hits and the day after. So social media graphics, a shareable, like, one-minute video to bring the themes of the encyclical home, something really dynamic and engaging. We have some good ideas about how we're going to get that out on the day the encyclical comes out as well. And action alerts to members of Congress with a quick summary of the encyclical and bringing that moral voice to bear on Congress. And, of course, a letter to the editor toolkit, like you all are so fabulous about using. So those are some of the tools that we want to get out to people right away. And some of what I think will be in the cycle in this huge moment. So look forward to hearing some questions.
Great. You know what? We're gonna have to move to the next part of the call. But let me just say that the recording of your talk, I think, is going to be one of the best tools that we have going forward. This was just absolutely spectacular, and I didn't get a chance to listen to your faith-based presentation at the National Conference last year, but Danny just raved about it, and I can see why now. This is This was phenomenal. And again, we'll make sure that this recording gets out. We would love to get you back to do some Q&A with us. And one of the things that I know we're going to want to partner with you on is we do plan to have 100 members of various clergy come to the conference with us this year, so that we're hoping that when we see everybody in the House and Senate, that there's somebody who can present the moral, faith-based view of this. Whether they're with us on policy or not is not the crucial issue, but simply to let everybody know in Congress that how important and appealing this is from a moral perspective. So, Lonnie, that was absolutely spectacular, and thank you for your work and for doing such a phenomenal presentation this morning.
Thanks so much. Sorry I went too long. I was too excited.
Oh, no. I wouldn't have had to take one word of that out, including that the Pope loves zingers.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell all my Catholic friends the Pope loves zingers.
Absolutely. I'll tell you some more later sometime, Mark.
Okay, fantastic. And if you want to stay on for the second half of the call, you're certainly welcome to, but if you have to drop off, we'll understand it. But thank you for presenting that and covering so much ground in such a short amount of time. We really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, whew, that was amazing. I hope we can keep that up for the second part of the call. So first thing we want to do is talk about some of the things that happened since last month's call. So Amy, can you come on for a second?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, we measure a lot of things every month. We don't measure everything. We only measure things that we know or strongly believe create political will. And so, obviously, we measure meetings with members of Congress and Parliament. There's nothing more important than we do than that. And actually, we had a really, really solid month. For a month where, you know, there people weren't necessarily in the district, to have, you know, 25 meetings with House reps, 18 with Senate staff, 3 with actual senators, 14 with members of Parliament. That was just, I don't know where all those happened, but that's really, really a remarkable month. And obviously we pay a lot of attention to things like letters to the editor and op-eds. We had 31 op-eds this month, which is a really, really good month, including Noel Sador got in the L.A. Times. Noel, that was an amazing piece, and I have been submitting to the L.A. Times myself for 6 years and never got in there, so congratulations. Also, I want to point to that this month we had 1,234 letters to members of Congress and Parliament, 1,234. So for every one of you who wrote one of those letters, thank you for doing that. Again, one of the things we hear from offices is they just don't hear from the public often enough. So if you could make that a regular practice, and we are regularly knocking 1,000 or more letters to members of the House, Senate, and to Parliament, that would be fantastic. Amy, as you look at this month's report, are there other things that jump out at you this month?
Yes, Mark. This month we looked at groups that had a large number of reports that they submitted, and I just wanted to take a moment to tell you all about them. California San Luis Obispo had 8 reports. Toronto, Canada had 18 reports. Colorado, Roaring Fork Valley had 13. Boston, Massachusetts, 29. Lakeville, Minnesota, 8. Southwest Minneapolis, 12. Two Harbors, Minnesota, 12. Portland, Oregon, 8. Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 18. Salt Lake City, 13. Washington State, Tri-Cities, 8. And 16 for Central Wisconsin.
Wow. So those are all, when you say reports, you mean that could be a combination of op-eds, letters to the editor, meetings with a member of Congress or Parliament, outreach events. So it's not just anything. It's only the things that we measure that we believe are crucial to creating political will.
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Amy, thank you for that. And congratulations. I know a lot of other groups did a ton of work, but congratulations to those of you who got, you know, significant volume. Very nice, very impressive. That definitely jumped off the page. All right, and then let's move over. So we had a couple of regional conferences since last month's call. I had the privilege of going to the one in Denver, you know, which is very meaningful to me. I grew up in Salt Lake, so to see people from Montana, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, And to be there by the beautiful Rocky Mountains was fantastic. Grant Couch made just such a beautiful plea for how important it is that we continue to reach out and build the conservative side of CCL, and such a well-organized event. Again, that was a life changer for me. Harold Hedelman is going to report on the piece of the San Francisco conference that had to do with a panel that we put together. So, Harold, are you there? Can you star six your phone to unmute it, and can you tell us about the panel?
Be happy to do that.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, last month, as part of our regional conference, we had three people come to a free public two-hour panel plus town hall discussion. The title was Pricing Carbon, Can Conservatives and Progressives Agree? The panel had a threefold mission. First, to show that leaders across the political spectrum support pricing carbon, to explore where they agree and disagree on how to price it, and to explore suggestions on how we should move forward. We had a panel of seven, including Mark, and just so you'll have a sense of the political spread, our three conservatives were the Western Regional Director for R Street Institute, the San Francisco Bay Area Republican Party Vice Chair, and the CEO of Enphase Energy. We had two progressives, the Energy and Climate Program Director of Next Generation, and the Sierra Club's Deputy Executive Director. And finally, we had a transpartisan, the founder of Future 500. Here's where they agreed. The big agreement was that pricing carbon as soon as possible is important, but it's not the only thing that we need to do. And second, that a carbon fee is a good strategy. Here's the differences. Progressives were not keen on revenue neutrality. They would like to use the revenue for things like retraining or infrastructure or global adaptation. Conservatives strongly opposed any deviation from revenue neutrality, and some of them preferred a tax shift over a dividend. We got two great strategic suggestions. First, avoid publicly forcing Republicans to express support for climate action too soon. Here's a quote. There is more support for a carbon fee and tax shift than you think. It's the most widely considered politically impossible idea in D.C., end quote. In other words, there are many Republicans right now who are afraid to come out of the closet, although they would like to. And so while they're there in the closet, we need to educate them behind closed doors and wait until a mass closet breakout looks possible. Hopefully, it'll be a stampede. Future 500 suggested working with consumer product manufacturers and retailers to get them to engage their supply chains and lobbyists in support of fee and dividend because, as Remy showed, it's good for their bottom line and it will improve their brand image. That's it.
Okay, fantastic. And again, just in case you missed the very first thing Harold said, 300 people out on a Friday night. And they would have stayed there all night if we would have let them. So congratulations to everybody in the Bay Area who was part of that. You can see a recording of that. We'll have a transcript of it. And again, it was phenomenal to be part of the panel and such a civil, beautiful engagement about could progressives and conservatives agree. Fantastic. Okay, let me just mention a couple of other things also. So I know that last month we released the video that was put together by the La Jolla Group. You've all probably seen that two-minute video. They've also created a two-week summer intern program for high school students where they go to Scripps Institution of Oceanography for 2 weeks, learn from the best climate scientists in the world, then they learn about composing themselves and their thoughts when speaking to politicians, culminating a meeting with their elected officials. So Scripps is going to be doing our La Jolla Group a training for high school students around the world. You could Google UCSD Academic Connections, UCSD Academic Connections, and find out about that. Okay, from Toronto. So this is Toronto's response to Mars One, which is attempting to colonize Mars 10 years from now. What they call Earth Two invites folks to sign up to stay on Earth and make it livable for future generations. By signing up to stay, you are supporting CCL and Carbon Fee and Dividend Solution. The Earth 2 team are developing a video, website, and support materials, and hopefully we'll have all of that ready for the April action. So I don't know if any of you who've seen Cheryl McNamara's videos in the past, but they've been brilliant, and we expect that something will be both really fun and poignant coming from that. So I love kind of playing off Mars One. Earth 2 counts also. All right, I want to mention a couple things about the upcoming national conference in June. Some people have told me they think that they can't lobby if they sign up now. we have space for 900 people to lobby. So we figured out how we can get 900 people into lobby meetings, and a little over 350 people have registered so far. So you can still get in lobby meetings, so don't hesitate to register if you're worried about you're still going to get into lobby meetings. You will if you register now. We know that if you come, not only will you see Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, Dr. James Hansen, Shiling Su, Sam Daly Harris, Marshall Saunders. So, you know, it should be a pretty good event. And then something that some people may already know is we found out that the House schedule changed. And so in addition to lobbying on Tuesday, we're going to open up lobbying on Wednesday also. So if it works for you, we'll have an optional lobbying day. We expect that we'll get most of the House staff seen on Tuesday, but that we want to get as many face-to-face meetings with members as possible. So we will extend the lobbying day to Wednesday, and everybody who wants to can stay for that. Okay, let's talk about what we're going to do this month. So first of all, in the U.S., we're asking people to schedule meetings with members of Congress during the spring recess. We gave you a whole bunch of things that you could talk about. So, for instance, let's say you have not done a briefing with your member of Congress on REMI. We're recommending doing a REMI briefing, and we've got a lot of resources and tools to help with that. Also, we are going to be doing another House REMI briefing in March. We're hoping to add a Senate one, but if you haven't actually briefed your member, that would be a good thing to do. We also have a lot of tools to brief your members of Congress on the border, and we found in debriefing the 507 meeting notes from June of last year during the conference that the border was the biggest issue in Congress. And when we say the border, we essentially mean three things. When people say, well, if we don't do something, what about China? I mean, if we do something, what about China? It's also when people say, if we do a border tariff, we'll hold up to WTO guidelines. We also call that the border. And the third thing we call the border is, well, won't the U.S. lose jobs if we do something and other countries do not? So here's the thing we found out. Last November, we also went back and lobbied 120 offices, and still the biggest issue is the border. So we have a presentation on CCLU on the border. We're doing another one in a couple of weeks. So you could go in and just specifically brief your member on the border. We know that I think it's either a third or the fourth of the people in Congress are Catholic. So certainly we could go in and do a briefing on the Pope. We could do a briefing on the different legislative proposals. There were five last year. There are two that have been submitted so far this year, and we've got plenty of information. And then also one other option, and we listed a chart and a little bit of background on the action sheet this month, is what would be the difference between just EPA regs by itself and a carbon fee and dividend. So all of those are possible options. Then in Canada, we're asking people to prepare comments for the what's going to be happening on the floor of Parliament, and also to prepare for Earth Week. So I didn't put Earth Week in the U.S. Action sheet, but we're assuming that this is our biggest opportunity every single month every year to do outreach. Earth Week is coming up, and hopefully everybody's doing their planning to get ready for that. Okay, then the last thing is this. The second U.S. action, and everybody in Canada is welcome to be part of this if you want, is we do two fundraising outreach efforts every year, one in the spring and one in the fall. You probably have an electronic copy of our spring appeal in your inbox right now. You'll be getting a paper copy shortly. And for anybody who it makes sense to contribute, that would be fantastic, and thank you for those of you who have contributed and those of you who will be able to contribute. We had a remarkable fundraising year last year. We had a goal of raising $1.5 million, which was more than the $900,000 we'd raised the year before. We talked to a fundraising consultant who told us that we were out of our minds and that trying to raise that amount of money with the resources we had, we couldn't do it, but we did. And part of the reason is we went from the most we'd ever raised from foundations was $50,000, and we raised $200,000 from foundations. And here's the big kicker, though. We call major donors anybody who donates more than $1,000 a year. And 2 years ago, we had two major donors. Last year, we had 140, and that's you. That's just the people, almost exclusively the people on this call, and we're extremely grateful for that. So we made a huge effort. We committed to raising $1.5 million. We did it. We're committed to raising $2 million this year. Now, we're also committed to always being the most bare-bones grassroots organization that's ever been out there. You know, in 2009, the United States had a chance to pass legislation to deal with global warming, and we failed. And Theda Scotchpole, the Harvard political scientist, wrote over a 100-page criticism. And at the heart of her criticism was the failure for there to be a grassroots effort. What she said was there was plenty of support inside the Beltway. What there was not was sufficient support in the field, and that's the organization we're committed to being. When we add staff, it's only to add people to continue to be able to support the grassroots effort in the way that people expect. So, for instance, we added Ricky Bradley last year. He's the person who created CCL Community. He's the person that created CCL University. He's the one who's made it very easy for people to update bios so that we can continue to maintain support as the organization continues to grow. We also added Tony Cerna last year. Tony is an IT specialist, and our IT department was kind of what we could put together with duct tape and Windex last year. So having someone who could push meeting notes back so that if there was a meeting at the national conference, we could push meeting notes back to liaisons and group leaders. That was just a really, really crucial piece. And when we add people, it will only be to make sure that we can support the grassroots efforts. Okay, here's the last thing I'll say about the fundraising piece. Lene Pentengill, our fundraising development director, had asked me to write a piece this spring about my grandson. So if you saw our newsletter, you know that my wife's first grandson was born about a week and a half ago. And, you know, she said, you know, why don't you write something saying you're more committed now than you ever were? And I said, well, it's just not true for me. I can't imagine being any more committed than I am. But then what happened is, over the last week and a half, as you know, new parents don't get a lot of sleep, and I've had the privilege of getting to go over to my daughter's house every evening and hold the baby for a couple of hours so they can get a little rest. And I'm about 1,000 times more committed than I was when that started. So, Lene, let me just say something about that. You were right. I was wrong. So I am way more all in than I ever was. So for anybody who can continue to invest, you know, we're not just committed to averting disaster. We are committed to making sure that my grandson Elliot's world is in a fantastic world to live in, and I know we'll pull that off. So if you can contribute this year, that would be amazing, and you'll get an electronic copy in your inbox today and a paper copy soon. Okay, here's the very last thing. So the original sustainability officer of science fiction, Spock, you can call him Leonard Nimoy if you want, but it'll always be Spock to me, died in the last 2 weeks, and so I thought we should all just give a send-off to Spock. You know, Spock's favorite line was, live long and prosper, live long and prosper. So I'm going to unmute all the lines for just a moment. And if you're in a group and you're not familiar with it, there's a hand sign that also goes with live long and prosper. So if you could show the other people in your group how to do that. And when I unmute the phones and come back in just a second, if we could get a live long and prosper shout out from everybody, that would be fantastic. Let me just say again to Lonnie Ellis, amazing, thank you so much. But let me unmute everybody for a second here.
Oh, yes. Okay.